So my name is Chris Gates, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. My sobriety date is October 5th of 1998, and nobody's more surprised about that than me. So I said I'm an alcoholic and an addict. What that means is I'm a binge drinker and a low-bottom heroin addict. That was, you know, but my story isn't really a story about drugs and alcohol as much as it is a story about ever-increasing spiritual malady. You know, my backstory, like I come from a happy, healthy, functional family with no alcoholics or addicts in it. Nobody even drank much in my house. There is a history of depression and suicide on my mom's side of the family because they didn't drink. And I can look back at the people who did it and go, that was untreated malady. The world they lived in didn't allow for any drugs or alcohol, so they just endured it as long as they could and then they killed themselves. So, but I come from this very happy, loving, supportive family, and I was a really happy little kid right up until the first day of first grade. And then I had to go to school, and there were all those other kids there, and they made me nervous and uncomfortable, and so I came home and I began to eat. Food was my first attempt to change how I felt. You know, there was no drugs or alcohol in my house, but there was Little Debbie's. And so, and you know, at 6 years old, that would work, you know. The story I grew up with was I started putting on weight when I began to go to school because I was such an active kid, and now I'm having to sit around all day. And I loved that story. It was horseshit. You know, it was, now I look back, now that I know what malady is, I can look back and see it as young as six. I was going to make a PowerPoint slideshow to go with my story, that just because I have this stuff here and I know how, but I totally didn't because, but you can look at my pictures from grade school, and by second and third grade, I'm not smiling anymore. You know, I had friends. I was still having a good time. It wasn't like it was always miserable, but you can see that malady begin to turn up. So I'm eating. I'm with the same 28 kids for 6 years, and I never make any real friends because one of the hallmarks of spiritual malady is a disconnection from other people. I liked them when I was at school with them, but then I'd go home and it wouldn't even occur to me that they might like me and we want to hang out after. And they didn't live in my neighborhood, so that was that. Then we moved about a mile at the end of sixth grade, and I ended up going to a different middle school than everybody I had gone to the first 6 years of school with. And I understand now that middle school is essentially a holding pen for hormonal lunatics. You know, my wife, this is my lovely wife over here, Jo. She's the one who taught me to live indoors. Yeah. We've got 20-year-old twin girls. They're my stepdaughters. And I remember their experience in middle school. But, like, even the head cheerleader feels different and left out on a bad day, right? It's middle school. But I was different. Like, when I was 7 years old, I saw the Rolling Stones on Ed Sullivan. This is like 1968, 69 something. And I knew I wanted to play guitar in a rock band. And I started growing my hair out. And I started hanging out with all the hippies because I grew up right by the UT campus. And buying records at garage sales and listening to anything I get my hands on. So I get to seventh grade. And all those kids are little clean-cut kids in North Austin. And I got the beginnings of long hair. And I'm walking around with a mono Panasonic tape recorder and an earphone in one ear listening to Black Sabbath. And I was different than those kids. And I also started going to concerts when I was about 12. And nobody I knew wanted to go, so my parents would just drop me off outside, or I'd ride my bike or something. And, you know, the first concerts I went to, surprisingly, there was a lot of marijuana smoking. But I went to a couple of the concerts, and they're all passing joints around, and it's like, these people don't, they seem like nice people. And I'm taking it and handing it to other people for the first couple of concerts. And I go, well, I'm just going to try. We'll see what happens. They seem like good people. And you know, so once I started, also surprisingly, it was much easier for a 13-year-old to get marijuana in Austin than alcohol in 1974. And so I found a guy that sold Mexican dirt weed a few blocks from my house and started smoking pot pretty regular. You know, the spiritual malady had gotten to a place where food wasn't doing it anymore, but food and weed, that went pretty good together, you know. So, you know, it got me through, right? And then I get to high school, and I start skateboarding. This guy who later was a singer in my first band came back from California in 1975 with the first urethane wheel skateboard I had ever seen, and we figured out a way to get one, and we all started skateboarding, and I found this small clique there's maybe 20 of us in the whole city that were riding, and they were my people, and I liked them, and I felt like I belonged to them. And I was a good student in school, and I'm smoking a lot of weed, and I'm you know, still eating, and the drinking age was 18 at the time, and by the time I was 16, I weighed 200 pounds, I was 6'1", and I had a beard and hair down to here. You know, so getting beer wasn't that hard either, especially by the campus. So I'm drinking, and I'm smoking weed, I'm still eating, and really the big picture of my story is, in the beginning, it was all great. I enjoyed the crap out of it. And then for a while, it was okay. And then there was a long stretch where it was kind of crappy. I was still kind of enjoying it, but it was kind of crappy. Then there was another long stretch where it was totally and completely crappy, and I wished I was dead most of the time, and I couldn't stop no matter what I wanted to do, and then I got sober. But in high school, it was still working for me. It was great. I was getting good grades. Like, you know, we went to my 30-year high school reunion a few years ago. My 20-year happened the month after I got out of rehab, so I didn't go to that one. But I went to my 30-year class reunion, and we're walking up to the front door. This guy comes over and goes, "Wow, Chris Gates, did you actually graduate with us?" Because I was missing 2 days of school a week, 3 days of school a week. But I was in the top 10 in the class. I told him, "Get off my back. If I get a B, you can give me some crap about it. But till then, leave me alone. I'm apparently not missing much." So high school was going pretty well. And then I graduated from high school and discovered punk rock at exactly the same time. And within a couple of months of graduating high school, I was starting school at UT and had formed my first real band with some of the guys I was skateboarding with. And we're playing at this club down on the drag all the time. And it's like the first time I walked in there, I went, "Oh, these are my people. This is the island of broken toys. It's where I belong." And I knew I wanted to be in the middle of that crowd. It was the first crowd I ever wanted to be in the middle of. You know, artists and weirdos, and, you know, there was a giant mural of rats in a sewer on one entire wall, and this is my place. And my band starts playing, and we start doing really good. And I'm still drinking, and I'm smoking a lot of pot. That's what everybody else there is doing. And I had this little episode around 20 where they thought I was trying to kill myself. I'm not sure what was happening. I don't register stress normally. And I was in school full-time, I was working full-time, and I was playing in a band full-time. And then one day they found me standing on the Congress Bridge crying, and I wouldn't talk to anybody, and they thought I was... So I don't know what was happening. I ended up in a hospital. This happens to me a few times. Depression is also a big part of my story. And not long after that, my drinking gets to a place where I'm starting to pass out. I don't black out, I pass out. And my friends like me, but they can't get my big dead ass weight back to the car. So they're, you know, rolling me on my stomach so I don't pull a Hendrix and leaving me where I drop, right? And I kind of start waking up in like the bushes at a frat house that I don't remember going to, or in the alley behind a diner off of Guadalupe, you know. And this music scene I'm a part of, everybody's drinking a lot, smoking a lot of weed, but there's some guys over there and they're doing a lot of speed. And they made me nervous when I first got there. But once I started passing out a lot, my response to that, this should have been a red flag, it wasn't. My response to that was to go buddy up with the speed guys. Not to ever go, "I probably shouldn't drink so much." You know. So I started doing speed. That biker crank was like peanut butter. You'd spend half the night going, "Oh my God, thank you. Oh my God." But I stopped passing out, so it was working for me, right? And then my first band, we do good. We make 4 or 5 records. We tour the country. You know, people are still buying some of those records. It was an amazing time. And that band breaks up. The next band gets together, and it's me and the guitar player from the first band, and my roommate's a singer, and our motto was show up drunk, show up late, don't show up at all. And we were just, we that band ran up a $225 bar tab on 50-cent beer. Yeah, I don't know. Like, we got there at 4 o'clock for sound check, and they had to get more beer before they opened the door. I don't know, but we were all also doing quite a bit of speed, so whatever. You know, that band made a couple of records, and we started touring, but it was still working because I was still having a pretty good time. You know, the meth hadn't become insane yet. And then I'm in California, And the whole rest of the band goes back to Texas. We've been out there on tour, and I stay because, you know, there's a girl. And I run into a couple of my buddies who I know from punk bands in California, they're L.A. punk bands, and they're all rocked out. And they go, yeah, man, we got this new band. You know, we're not doing that anymore. We're doing this other thing. And I'd gotten pretty good on the guitar by this point. And so I go to them with their first show is at this big apartment complex in the middle of Hollywood where, like, a bunch of my friends live. I go down to the basement. It's a room not quite as big as this. And their band played their first show, and Faster Pussycat played their first show, and Guns N' Roses played their fifth show. And I go, I'm moving to L.A. This is like discovering punk rock. I'm moving to L.A. So that's what I did. I packed up my stuff, and I loaded up the car, and I headed to Beverly, you know. And you know, it was like recreating middle school because all the guys there were, like, dressed like girls and trying to sound like Poison with big poofy hair. And then I show up, you know, and the spandex don't come in up 38 ways, you know, which is awesome because I don't have anything to explain from that period, you know. And, you know, a month or so after I get there, I meet this beautiful little goth girl who's dealing the best meth I've ever seen in my life. Not the crank I had in Texas. This is, you got to crush it. You know, and it was love at first 7-day run, you know. She told me at the end of that week, you don't want to get involved with me. And I should have listened, but you know, we're there. She's everything I need. It's 2 blocks from my house. And that band, you know, we were completely different than everybody else. We looked like bikers. We're all punk rockers that look like bikers. And we're playing this music that didn't sound like everybody else. And 9 months in, we got a record deal. Like, I don't know how that happened, but it did. And the next thing I know, I got videos on MTV. I got all this pressure. It's my band. I'm writing all the music. I'm doing all the business. And somebody else is singing because nobody wants to see me front a band. But it's a lot of pressure, and my speed use is going up and up. And now I'm drinking because I've done too much speed. I need to take the edge off a little. And but the first record comes out, the video's all over MTV, I'm getting ready to go on my first major tour, and about 5 days before that tour's getting ready to start, and I'm dealing meth at this point, we're selling it out of the house like you do, and the DEA comes through the front door of the cook, that's my partner, and his wife calls me while they're in the house, what do we do, and I'm like, wrong number, you know, and I sat down with my girlfriend, and we had this conversation, and I think what we thought we were talking about was not doing drugs anymore. You know? I mean, it was like, and I sat down, and we looked at each other, and we're like, you know, dudes like me don't get opportunities like this. And I don't want to burn it down for this thing that I didn't know it was already too late to quit doing. And so we made this decision. We're not dealing anymore. We'll figure it out later. You know, if we're not dealing it, we're not buying it, that's for sure. And I leave and go on the road. And within 2 weeks, I'm drinking the better part of a fifth of vodka and a case of beer every night and doing whatever blow I can talk other people into giving me. And within 2 weeks, she's completely strung out on heroin because we were well and truly past the point of being able to stop. And then I get back from the tour, and I'm paying for the dope, so I go, fuck it, I'm doing half, right? And I, you know, I figured I've been awake for 8 years. I could use a nap, you know. And so I let go of the speed and I switched to heroin. And it fixed what was wrong with me in a way that nothing else ever did. You know, meth was great for a while because meth removes all doubt. I feel confident and it's all good. I still feel rotten inside, but I'm absolutely confident that what I'm doing is the right thing. But after a while, that gets nuts, you know. Especially when the right thing is like staring out the window with tracer bullets, you know. But you know, they're coming to get me. Who? That squad of people that spies on people no one else cares about. But so I switched to heroin, you know, like you do. Bigger and bigger band-aids, right? Everybody in L.A. was strung out on dope, and I stayed the next 3 years. I'd go on tour, and there was a doctor, there's always a doctor, who would give you what you needed so that you could kick while you're on the road. And I would be drinking like a crazy person and doing whatever other drugs I could get, but in the late 80s, early 90s, you couldn't find heroin on tour. So you had to stop. Everybody would have to kick the first week and then just go out and play the music and not have their drug of choice. And then I'd come home and stop doing everything else and go right straight back to heroin. You know? So it was, I'm on tour and I'm drinking like an insane person and I'm doing whatever powders people will give me and I'm sleeping with as many women as I can because surely some combination of this will make me feel okay. And it didn't. You know, I have this memory twice actually, once in front of about 18,000 people in San Francisco and once in front of over 40,000 at the Monsters of Rock in England. And I'm playing and there's this huge crowd and they're all cheering. And I look up and I see myself on the Diamond Vision. And my thought is, man, if I get laid, this will be awesome. Like it was already awesome and I was missing it. I'm pretty sure I did get laid and I'm almost positive I went to bed angry and miserable. You know? Because no amount of sex and no amount of alcohol and none of it would fix what was wrong with me. They weren't big enough Band-Aids anymore. I'm on the same label as Nirvana, and when that record comes out, because we're all punk rockers, we look at each other and went, well, it's been nice, time to get a job. And so I went out and got a job managing a production for this fashion accessories designer, and I was making enough money. I worked for him for about 9 months and realized I had made enough money to stay strung out forever. And that scared me to death. And I had been like trying to kick on methadone in L.A. over and over again and failing. And, you know, nobody I knew was in recovery. And that's not entirely true. There were like 3 people I knew that had gotten sober, but I didn't know where they went. I hadn't seen them in a while, you know. And so I go home one day and my girlfriend, who still lives with me, but is not talking to me because I'm not paying for her dope anymore. And tell her I'm moving to Texas. I can't get sober here. I'm dying in L.A. There's not a good reason for me to be here anymore. I got to go home. And at the last minute, she goes, can I come too? And I went, okay. So I sold half of everything I owned and bought a crappy van and put the other half of the stuff in it. And her and me and her cat climbed in that van and headed to Texas. It took 4 days to get here because heroin is not a good cross-country drug. That was a lot of pulling over to nap, you know. And I get back to Texas, and we land at my dad's house, and we're not drinking or doing anything because my dad doesn't drink. There's no drug. We have no money. And 2 weeks into that, she has a psychotic break, and we have to call EMS. And they kept asking me, what did she take? What's she on? And I know now that what she was on was untreated malady, that she held on for all she could, was worth and lost her mind for 3 days. And when she got out of the hospital, we brushed off our Spanish. We headed to Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, like you can do in every town in America, and found drugs. And for me, once moving didn't fix anything, it's like all bets were off. And you got to understand, I'm a nice boy from a good family, basically. Like, I was carrying a gun in L.A. most of the time because, you know, my friends couldn't know that because they were idiots. But, I was telling somebody earlier, like, I copped drugs during the L.A. riots at the corner where Reginald Denny was pulled out of his truck and nearly beaten to death 4 hours after that happened. The only people on the streets were the rioters, the looters, the dope dealers, and me. You know? And the person I was talking to was saying, weren't you scared? And I was going, yeah, but I was heavily armed and I was totally willing to kill anybody that tried to fuck with me. You know? And so that's who I had turned into. And I came back to Austin. We started using again. I got a job working at a nightclub where they thought I was sober because I didn't drink or do all the coke they were doing. They had no idea what heroin use looked like, you know, or why I was in the bathroom for so long. But and I just didn't care anymore. Like, I was too afraid to kill myself because I had no proof that that would fix anything. But I became reckless. I got involved with a bunch of people that a guy like me should never have even met. I ended up collecting money for a guy who in the Latin Kings who ran a sports book because his brother was my dealer, you know, and I'm buying weight from him. And next thing I know, I'm carrying a gun around and threatening doctors, you know. And I'm a nice boy from a good family. That's not who I am, not even sort of. But that's where it got to. That's what that untreated malady took me to. And I spent most of the last 2 years I was using trying to not use. One detox after another, one thing after another. But I didn't know anybody that was sober that really. I actually went to about 6 AA meetings during the course of that 2 years. Same meeting every time. I didn't know that different meetings were different. If you don't know that, different meetings are different. The meeting I went to was kind of a 5:30 p.m. social club at Bolden at the time. And they'd all say, just don't drink no matter what. And they'd all fuck off and go to dinner and not tell me about anything. Leave me with a heroin addiction I don't know what to do about. Like, I didn't even know this place was here because nobody bothered to tell me. And then I'm sitting at my desk one day working on this pistol for my dad. You know, I grew up around lots of guns and stuff. My dad's a collector. We have a cabinet full of muzzle-loading weapons from the pre-Civil War. And I'm working on this target pistol for him because his hands aren't very good. And my dealer shows up, and I find myself sitting at my desk with a loaded gun in one hand and a loaded syringe in the other, trying to decide which one to use. And it wasn't that alcoholic addict, like, why doesn't somebody see how broken I am? It wasn't that at all. I had done that plenty of times. But this time, it was just calmly, today or forever, what's it going to be? And for just a minute, I swear to God, I was across the room looking at my own back, going, how the hell did that become my only options? I used to have a life. I was on MTV for a hot minute. Now, literally, today or forever, that's all I got. There's got to be something else. And I have no idea what it is. And later that day, this is the first time God showed up. Later that day, I'm surfing channels, and I land on 2020, the news magazine. And since I'm a kid, anything that's on TV about music, I stop and watch it. I don't care. Sonny and Cher, summer variety show, don't care watching it. Because back then, there was nothing. You know, magazines and album covers and nothing. And so I land on 2020, and they're doing a feature about this jazz saxophone player named Buddy Arnold. And they're going, yeah, he played with all the greats in the 50s and the 60s, and they're showing clips and the music. And then they say, and he was a heroin addict for 30 years. And I go, wow, that's a weird thing to include. And then they said, but now he's been sober for 10 years, and he's formed an organization funded by the Grammys whose sole purpose is to pay for professional musicians to get help. And I went, oh, my God, that's my shot. Right there, that's my shot. So I ran into the other room, and I got on my computer, but it took like 6 minutes to get the website up because it's 1998. So I was, you know, it took 5 minutes for the page to load because there's one little picture. But I managed to get their phone number, and I called them the next day. And I'd like to say I was ready and they took me to treatment, but I had enrolled in school because what I needed was some education and some structure, you know. And I had 26 days before school started. And they wanted me to go to treatment for 30 days. I said, can I leave 4 days early? I got to start school. And they said, call us back when you really want to go. I went, okay. So I held on, did the best I could, started school. 2 weeks into school, I went, I'm ready to go now. You know, my life's not getting better 2 weeks into school. I got to do something. And so I called them, and they put me in touch with the treatment center I ended up going to. But when that treatment center found out that I was on methadone, they said, we can't take you on that methadone. You just need to stop taking that methadone, and we'll see you in 6 weeks. And what they were saying, without saying it out loud for liability reasons, is go back to using heroin full-time because that detox we can deal with. But if you come into treatment on the dose of methadone you're on, you'll be so sick the whole month you're here, you won't get out of bed. So that's what I did. And that turned out to be the second time God showed up. You know, because I had been working with a net for a while, right? If I didn't have any money today, it was okay. I wasn't going to get sick. I'm on methadone. But I had to spend a month facing my addiction full on. And if today is the day the dude sleeps and doesn't call anybody, we're screwed. And I'm having to do things I don't want to do anymore for 6 weeks, waiting to get ready to come. And that was a gift because I really got to look at how ugly my life was. And then the third time God showed up, my girlfriend, who's just as strung out as me, she comes to me. And like, you got to understand, at this point, I've been dead 4 times in the last 6 months. Full respiratory arrest. By the time I get enough heroin in me to get some relief, I'm in respiratory arrest. You know, who knew my roommate knew CPR, right? But I keep dying and being brought back and dying and brought back. I don't want to get sober because I'm afraid of dying. I want to get sober because I can't stay dead. And my girlfriend comes to me and goes, look, you need to think about why you're going to do this. Because if you go for the wrong reasons and it doesn't work, I'm pretty sure you're going to die for good next time. Now, this coming from a girl who's so strung out she can't find her hands with, you know, one hand with the other, you know. But that thought She had that. She was given that thought, and she said it to me. So I got to spend about a week or 10 days thinking about that. And at first I thought I was going because I keep getting arrested and my health is at risk and this I can't keep coming up with the money and having to do this stuff. But then I realized that the reason I'm really going is because I can't function without this drug. Like, not high. This hasn't been recreational drug use in a long time. It's vocational drug use at this point, you know. And I can't go to the grocery store or pay my cable bill or do anything else unless I'm high first. And other people do that all the time. And there has to be a way for me to do that too. And I don't know what that is. And that's why I'm going, to find out how to live without that drug. And that was a gift, because it was important that I know why I'm going. So I land in treatment. And it's an amazing place. Guys there sat down with me and helped me look at the first step and make sense out of my own drinking and using history. I spent 2 weeks arguing about whether or not God existed with other people in rehab, you know. But I also realized that everybody there that had relapsed and was back in treatment didn't do a fourth step. So whatever that is, I got to do it. And I got busy. And I was lucky because the guy at the treatment center who sort of ran the 12-step education part, his whole message was, do it fast. Let's get you an intentional connection to this power quickly. Don't try to understand what you're doing. Just do it. Figure out what you did after the fact. And when I got out, I landed in the hands of a bunch of guys who were working the same ideal. And I walked into a meeting 5 or 6 days out of treatment. I saw a guy whose band and my band used to play together. And in the 1984, we'd draw straws to see who was going to play last, because whoever played last was too loaded to play. And that was still funny because we were in our 20s. But I walked in. Here's this guy, and he's happy, and he's sober, and he's still playing music. So he became my sponsor. I did my fifth step within a week of getting out of treatment. I was making amends within 2 weeks of getting out of treatment. It was amazing. And then I remember, at about 120 days sober, I'm talking with my sponsor and I'm finishing up on most of my direct amends. And I'm talking to him going like, dude, I think the promises are happening. I think I've found what you're telling me the program's going to give me. And he looked at me and went, no, you haven't. And instead of getting mad, I went, what are you talking about? And he said, you're better than you've been in 20 years. And you're still so far from good, it freaks me out every time I see you. And I'm going, oh, God, it gets better than this? And he's going, yes, please don't stop. It gets so much better. Please don't settle for this. I thought I was doing awesome. The guy who got me this job is on the board at Austin Recovery, was in my original home group, and he said for the first 6 months they were all certain I was going to freak out and kill them all at one of the meetings. He also told me my sponsor lost $10 when I got 60 days. So I was rough shape, but I thought I was doing great. And I've struggled a lot with the God part, right? Most of you guys have heard me talk about that. And so I end up in a group. And I'm not saying the Lord's Prayer, you know. There's a lot of Lord's Prayer saying when I got sober. And, you know, if they're saying the Lord's Prayer, I'll hold the hands, but I'm not saying the Lord's Prayer. And I'm looking around the room to see who's cool like me, not saying the dumb prayer. And that's just what I do. And for the first 6 months I was sober, I had a little bit of a stammer, and I had a hard time making whole sentences. And a lot of times during the first couple of months, I would go to the meeting, I'd stand outside for about 5 minutes after the meeting with everybody talking and smoking, and I'd go home and sit in the dark for an hour because I was so overstimulated. If you're experiencing that, that's normal. It's okay. But at 6 months, I learned to make whole sentences, and that was really all it took to get laid at my home group. And so everybody says don't get a relationship for the first year, but nobody knows how that works because nobody really does it. So I created some havoc. Back then, there was a thing called the Bolden breakup, which is you sleep with an inappropriate person for a couple of weeks, and then she gets the 5:30, and I get the 8, and she gets Rudamaya, and I get Flipnotics, and we split up the meetings in the coffee shops. And it happened so many times, it was a thing, you know. And so I stopped. I realized that I was shitting where I eat. And I was getting made to where I can't really go to one of my home groups anymore. And so I stopped. And I learned how to be just me. Because I was convinced that I needed a woman to feel whole. I was convinced I had to find somebody that wanted me because nobody wanted me. And so if anybody showed any attention at all, I go, oh, I got to have that one because there's not going to be another one, even though my entire life is one relationship after another. My experience doesn't hold up the idea I have in my head that there's a scarcity out there of anybody who's ever going to want a dude like me. But that's how I felt. And I was certain that a woman was going to fix it for me. So I spent a year not dating anybody. Not the first year, 6 months to 18 months. And then I went to a reunion at my home group at about 16 months sober. Amazing speakers all morning. We're taking a break to get ready to have lunch, and 800 people gather up in a circle, holding hands, start saying the Lord's Prayer. So I do what I do, looking around at that big-ass circle, trying to see who's not saying the prayer. And I got halfway around that circle, and it occurred to me that if these people were even half as insane and miserable and hopeless as I was when I got here, this is a miracle. And it's the first time that word ever had any substance. You know, oh, it's a miracle. You know, it's not. But this, I mean, I always say it's 800 crackheads and junkies and alcoholics fully clothed in their right mind enjoying a Saturday in Kerrville. That's a miracle. If we'd have descended on that town using, it would have been another kind of miracle. You know, but it was at that moment, having worked an active program for 16 months, that the cumulative effect of all the spiritual experiences I had woke me up. And I realized that things were not what I believed, that my perception of the world had shifted, and that I knew this would work if I kept doing it. I had so much experience now that it was undeniable. So I came home, and I've been working the first 11 steps, you know, collecting power for Chris, but I hadn't really been working with anybody much. So I start raising my hand, trying to be attractive, right? Because program of attraction rather than promotion, which is utter horseshit, really. You know, the 11th tradition has nothing to do with the 12th step. It's not a program of attraction rather than promotion inside the rooms of AA. Once somebody makes it into that room, it is a program of promotion. I'm supposed to draw you with a vision of what's possible. And sitting here and raising my hand and going, whew, nobody picked me, that's not what that is. Also, I learned that my spiritual growth is absolutely contingent on working one-on-one with other alcoholics and addicts. That means I can do fourth step all day long, fifth step all day long. I can get a vision of God's will in step six. I can ask him to help me be somebody different in step seven. I can make amends if I have to in eight and nine. But if I don't do 12 and I'm not channeling this power onto the next guy, I may not grow enough to be different the next time the situation arises. You know, my sponsor had been urging me into small bits of service after about 8 or 9 months of sobriety because he didn't think I'd stay sober if he didn't, and he was probably right. You know, we encourage people not to be a sponsor before they get a year because relapse tends to go down 70% after 12 months of continuous sobriety. We don't want sponsors relapsing. A lot of you guys won't make it to a year if you wait that long to try and start being a service and sponsor. I wouldn't have. But at 16 months, I started, like my first sponsee, he was a brand new, like he had just gotten out of 6-day detox at Shoal Creek, this Irish dude with red hair, and he's still shaking and kind of see-through. And I walked up to him at the end of the meeting and introduced myself and said, do you have a sponsor? He said, no. I said, well, then I'll be your sponsor. When he got a year, he said, I just thought that was his turn. I didn't know how it worked. You know, like, and I started working with him. You know, I sponsored a lot of guys. For the first year, 20 or 30 guys, and only two of them ever made it to the fourth step. But what I got out of that was an incredibly good understanding of the first four steps. Because it's really easy to have a partial understanding of something if you're only learning it for your own use. But you have to start trying to explain what you know to somebody, you find the holes in your learning. And this is my life we're talking about here. I don't need a partial understanding of how not to die. You know? So transmitting that power and carrying that message is vital. So life continued on, and all the things that I thought I had lost came back. I thought music career is over. And then in 2000, I get a phone call from this record label in L.A. We had two albums worth of material we had recorded for our third record that didn't come out. And they want to release these two things. And then they find out we've got a live recording of a sold-out show from the peak of the band's popularity. And they go, oh, let me fly you out and let's mix that and put that out. So I fly out to L.A. to mix this record. And this band called the Super Suckers from Seattle are doing Two Nights at the House of Blues. And somehow they think we're playing again. So they call and say, you want to play Two Nights at the House of Blues with us? And I go, yeah, sure, that'd be great. So the band comes back together. And then we go to Europe. Then we go to Japan. Then we go to Europe 4 or 5 more times, and Japan again. And I'm getting to do all this stuff and be sober for it. I don't remember much about the touring before. I also realized that I had no marketable job skills, so I had to go back to school. I was really good at stuff that nobody would pay me to do, or I wasn't comfortable doing sober. That was my life. So I went back to school, and I learned to do web development, commercial art and web development. And that's what I did for about 10 years, worked for myself. Built a pretty good business till the economy collapsed in 2009. I also knew I wanted to have the kind of relationship I have now, and I had no idea how to put that together. But I got with a sponsor who did know how to put it together, and he walked me through a 2.5 or 3 year process that got me ready to be in the relationship I'm in now. So like everything I ever wanted to do, I'm getting to do again the right way and for the right reasons. I'm not trying to get something from it that it doesn't give. I just get to show up and be me and enjoy the thing for its own sake. Like when I got sober, I heard him say, we're certain that he wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And my first thought was, that sounds great, but not all the time, right? And then after a minute, I went, why not all the time? What are my ideas around those words that make all the time impossible? And I realized that when I said happy, what I meant was euphoric. And that I had spent my whole life pursuing pleasure, thinking it would make me happy. But pleasure, by its nature, is transitory. It happens and it's over. So I thought happiness doesn't stay because pleasure didn't stay. But what if happiness is being connected to a higher power and having the serenity that I did all that drugs and alcohol trying to find? What if that's what happiness is? The ability to sit on my couch and not do anything and feel at peace. Because I couldn't do that. It was like the TV's on and I'm playing a game on my phone and playing the guitar at the same time. And I'm still needing something else to distract me because that's not enough. But what if happiness is just serenity? That might be doable all the time. And when I said freedom, what I meant was no accountability ever. I want to do whatever I want and never have any consequences and never get in any trouble. But you know, I've been living my life that way for a long time. And I was in fear all the time that the other shoe was going to drop, that they were going to catch me, that it was all going to come unraveled. And it turns out that real freedom is freedom from fear. And how I get that freedom from fear is by trusting God and taking action until the thing's not scary anymore. And then I could take the happiness that I've found and the freedom that I've found and go out into the world and do things I love to do the right way and for the right reason and find joy. And that is doable all the time. I mean, I'm not doing it all the time yet, but I'm doing it way better than I was 2 years ago or 5 years ago, much less when I first started. Please don't put the line between good and bad at sober. Because then you're good right up until you're loaded. Put the line between good and bad at happy, joyous, and free. That way, if you're not feeling it, you can go, oh, I have work to do. Because that line hasn't moved, I have. And that keeps getting high in the way in the rearview mirror. I start getting uncomfortable and not enjoying my life and do step work way before relapse happens. A couple years ago, I had a conversation. I go outside the fellowship every so often and talk to people from other spiritual walks. And I had a conversation a few years ago with several different people, and this concept came up where one of them kept calling it the other side of humility. You know, in AA we talk about humility meaning right-sized. And for us that means stop trying to do the thing only God can do and start trying to do the thing only you can do. But the other side of humility is that every one of us are born with talents, things innate to us. And if I'm going to be humble and right-sized, it's my job to develop that talent to the maximum benefit of myself and the world. And some people's talents are big and showy, and people go, ooh, when you do them. And other people's talents are small and quiet, but they all matter. And I'm having this conversation with people, and I've been told that when I talk about the steps, I do it in a way that people can hear and that's simpler and it's a completely different approach than most people. And I've been told that my whole sobriety, but I never knew what to do with that. Like if you told me, man, I love your band is so awesome, I'd say thank you because I worked hard to make it good. But this other thing just happened, which means it's a talent. And so I started, after this conversation, I started going, what should I do with that? I mean, I'm working one-on-one with a lot of guys, but maybe I need to work with larger groups of people. I don't know what that looks like. When I'm sitting down talking to my wife about it, going, I don't know if it's a blog or a podcast or a YouTube. I don't know. And then 3 weeks later, I run into the guy who offers me this job, which required a lot of inventory. It scared me. Oh, my God, now I have to show up and be the guy they keep telling me I am. And then I got here, and things were just as nuts, and I did a lot of inventory. My life keeps growing. That requires more step work so I can stop being afraid of the new stuff. You know, like I said, my life just gets better and better. If it stopped right now, that'd be awesome. You know, but nothing in 19 years shows me it's going to slow down. So my job is to keep up spiritually. You know, I always do this analogy, like, when I got sober, it's like building this little tiny house, pouring a little bitty slab and building a tiny house on it, 400 square feet. It's little, but it's mine. And if I stay sober, at 6 months, it's 800 square feet. And at a year, it's 1,000. At 2 years, it's 1,900, and there's an upstairs master bath bedroom. But if I'm not pouring more spiritual foundation, the weight of that life will fall in on me. So my job is to keep up. This never stops. The cool thing is, whole new set of problems, same tools. I know exactly how they work. I also know how I go about it. I go, hey, oh, fucking inventory. You know, the thing I learned most recently, and I've known this in the past, but I forgot. I've been facing a lot of sort of long-term challenges, things that don't go away quickly, that are scary. In some case, painful and uncomfortable physical issues. And what I find myself doing is holding my spiritual breath and losing my connection to God and going, I'll reconnect when. And my job now is to learn to connect during, because it's not going to be over soon. And if I can connect now, I can have the peace and ease. I can have happy, joyous, and free, even though it's still scary, even though it still hurts. Even though I don't know what the answer is yet, which is so much better than all those things being going on and not being connected to God. And so that's my job today, is to continue that connection. And it's funny, because all these years later, I still don't say the Lord's Prayer. At the end of the meetings when they say it, I still don't say it. But it's for a completely different reason. These days, instead of saying the words, I listen to the music. I knew we'd get here eventually. And it's just the best fucking song ever. I can't wait to see what you guys accomplish. Because I'm not special. You know, if you do what I do, you get your version of what I get. Every time. So do it. What are you waiting for? Are you in? Are you out? There is no middle ground. I've buried 12 of you that I know of in 2 years. I'd like to stop doing that so much. You know, if you do what I do, you'll get what I get. How good are you willing to let it be? You know, that's the question in front of you. And I'm here to help. Thanks.